From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the show, with today's deadline for enrollment in the Affordable Care Act looming, we look at how the act is rolling out in Wisconsin. Later, a historical perspective on how managing Milwaukee County got so unwieldy.
In many ways, the die was cast at the very beginning when Wisconsin and then was part of the Michigan Territory, and the territorial government in Detroit created the county to handle courts and taxation.
And how some are hoping the 100th anniversary of the passenger pigeon's extinction will spur action.
What we're hoping to do is make people vigilant. I mean, if something as abundant as a passenger pigeon can be wiped out in 40 or 50 years, something less common can go in an eye blink.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Great to have you listening today. Today marks a significant milestone in the Affordable Care Act. March 31st is an enrollment deadline for people to sign up for health insurance coverage. But it's not quite that simple. Additionally, the news came out in recent days that Wisconsin was ahead of the pace in terms of signing people up for coverage through the federal marketplace. But again, the equation isn't quite that simple. Donna Friedsam joins us on the phone this morning to help explain the nuances. She's director of health policy programs at the UW Population Health Institute in Madison. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in the simplest of terms, can you explain the significance of today's deadline, especially within the context of these other extended deadlines we've heard about in recent days as well?
So as of today, people who want to enroll or apply for coverage through the Affordable Care Act or for health insurance coverage this year need to have applied or be in the process of applying. So today is the deadline for the open enrollment. They won't have that opportunity again until next open enrollment period, which starts November 15th in the fall. Now, that being said, people have probably heard a lot of different information about extended deadlines, special deadlines, and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
So it gets rather confusing in that if people have been on Badger Care, Wisconsin's Badger Care program, and are losing that eligibility, many of them do qualify for a special extended enrollment period and will have the opportunity to enroll through June 1st. So it's not that this March 31st deadline applies to absolutely everybody in the state. If they are currently on Badger Care and losing that eligibility, generally that means people who are parents and caretaker adults who are between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty level, they will have, in all likelihood, a special enrollment period that will allow them to apply for the Affordable Care Act coverage up until June 1st. There are a number of other people who qualify for special enrollment periods, but for the most part, March 31st is the date that people need to have applied for coverage or be in the process of applying for coverage.
And so for most people, this is kind of like the open enrollment deadline for anything. There's a period if you're covered by traditional health insurance through your job, there's a period during which you're able to enroll and then it's use it or lose it.
Exactly. And it should be noted that this doesn't only apply for plans through the Affordable Care Act. Any health insurance plans that are offered in the state will only be offered during these open enrollment periods. So if people are thinking, well, I'll just buy my coverage outside of the Affordable Care Act or an off-exchange plan, they will find that they won't be able to purchase a plan during these outside of the open enrollment period either. So they need to have applied or be in the process of applying by today, March 31st.
What do we know about how Wisconsin has done thus far in total signups through the Affordable Care Act, especially in comparison to other states?
We're speaking at a time where, as you are likely aware, there's been a lot of action over the last week. As people are wont to do, many people wait until the very end, and there's been quite a bit of activity. And so I actually don't have the most current numbers that are veiled. They have not been publicized. You've probably heard that the White House released figures on Thursday of last week that said that as a nation, there had been over 6 million now that had selected a plan through the ACA marketplaces, but we don't have state-specific numbers. Those are not available. What I do have are the figures as of March 1st, so what happened between October of last year and up until March 1st. And what we saw there is that 71,443 individuals in Wisconsin up until March 1st had selected a plan through the Affordable Care Act. And beyond that, an additional 68,000-plus people had applied for coverage through the Affordable Care Act and then been found to be eligible instead for Medicaid. So that's approximately 150,000 people that went to the ACA marketplace and found some kind of coverage, be it ACA private plan coverage or getting themselves connected to Medicaid coverage through the state. But let's just stick with the 71,000 that selected a private plan through the ACA marketplace, or some people call it Obamacare marketplace. At that point, that 71,000 put our state somewhat ahead of where the state was projected to be in terms of total enrollment. So the federal government had set these guideposts where they expected states to be in terms of number of people that would have selected a plan at month one, month two, month three, month four, month five. And at the point of March 1st, when we had the 71,000-plus people who had selected a plan, Wisconsin was actually at 113% of what the federal government had anticipated would be the number of people that would have selected a plan in the state. So that sounds like, wow, we're doing really well in terms of our sign-ups and our enrollment. But there's a reason that we're showing that kind of activity that might not necessarily mean that we're getting a lot of uninsured people covered. The reason being that we have in Wisconsin a unique situation whereby we are implementing two policies at once. We're implementing the Affordable Care Act and all the coverage and enrollment activity that's going on there. And at the same time, we are implementing Governor Walker's entitlement reforms. So Governor, as I mentioned earlier, Governor Walker's entitlement reforms involve moving a number of people off of their current Medicaid and Badger Care coverage and having them transition from that coverage and offering them the opportunity to apply for coverage through the Affordable Care Act instead.
So these are people who are coming off the rolls and then going right back on a different roll?
Hopefully. So the hope is that those people don't come off the Medicaid Badger Care rolls and then go become uninsured. The hope is that they actually do pick up other coverage. It would be not good for our state or for anyone if they move off of their Medicaid Badger Care coverage and become uninsured instead. So what's been happening is there's about 77,000 adults in that category that are losing their Badger Care coverage because of the change in eligibility under Governor Walker's plan. And there's been enormous activity at the state level, huge activity there in Milwaukee, with the Milwaukee Enrollment Network, with the Milwaukee Healthcare Partnership, and others that have been working very hard specifically to get these 77,000-plus adults that are losing their Badger Care eligibility connected to the ACA coverage. So when we see this number that's put out by the federal government that says 71,000-plus people in Wisconsin have selected ACA coverage or selected a plan, we don't know how many of those people are people who had been uninsured, who are coming to find new coverage, or whether a lot of those are representing simply the people who had been on Badger Care who are picking up this ACA coverage instead.
And to go back to your earlier point, these are people for whom the deadline is not actually today, but is June 1st.
Most of the people, not all of the people, but yes, most of the people. But having said that, I don't know that the people out there really understood that their deadline was June 1st. And so there's been this enormous activity to try to get the people who were losing their Badger Care coverage as of April 1 April 1 is the day that they're losing their coverage.
Right.
So whether or not they are picking up their other coverage on April 1, they are losing their Badger Care coverage April 1. So I guess the point here is to say, even if you read these articles in the national press that show all the states, and it shows Wisconsin at, as they did in March, where it says, oh, Wisconsin's at 113% of the federal target for enrollment, well, you have to temper that with the idea that, well, we're actually moving a bunch of people from Medicaid to ACA. So are we really hitting our target in terms of trying to move uninsured people into ACA coverage, or are we just moving them from one kind of coverage to another kind of coverage?
Do we know anything about the demographic breakdown of who has been signing up, who signed up early, and who is still out there?
We do have some limited information, but unfortunately not as much as we would like. So what we know, we only know it as of March 1st. So we don't know about everybody who's been coming in the last couple of weeks, but I can speak about the people who've been coming as up till March 1st. In terms of gender, Wisconsin pretty much reflected the national breakdown. So we had about 44-56 in terms of 56% women, 44% men. In terms of age, which is something that everybody's been watching, Wisconsin's group of enrollees tend to skew older. So while the national age breakdown was, everybody was looking at this group of people in the ages 18 to 34, which are the young people that are considered healthier and less likely to incur a lot of expenses and therefore very desirable to have in the risk pool. The national pool up till March 31st had about 25% of those people. In Wisconsin, we had about 21% of those people. So there was great discussion about how, oh, Wisconsin's risk pool is older and therefore probably sicker and going to, you know, incur more expenses, and that's going to make our rates higher. So we don't know whether, though, in these last few weeks, there's been success in getting the younger people into the pool. We have no idea at this point.
So these last few weeks are potentially going to be fairly critical in terms of how the marketplace will function moving forward.
Absolutely. There's not only in Wisconsin, but nationally, and I'm sure people have been aware of the efforts at the federal level to try to get more of the young, healthy people into the pool, and there's been those same efforts here in Wisconsin. That being said, even at 21% and 25%, the pool seems to be healthy enough to make the program viable from an actuarial perspective. So it doesn't look like, you know, a pool that's going to be financially too risky to make it not work from a financial perspective. Now, the big question is, are the rates going to go up a lot next year based on the experience of the pool they have this year? And that, you know, that's why it's very important. Everybody wants to know who's signing up this year. What are they going to look like? The March data, we also saw that in Wisconsin, 89% of people who were coming to the Affordable Care Act marketplace were actually finding themselves qualifying for federal subsidies for their premiums. So this is something that's very important for people to understand, that when they look at the premium price that's listed, it may look very expensive to them, but they should understand that most people in Wisconsin are going to qualify for some tax credits that are going to subsidize the cost of those premiums. Like I said, 89% of people as of March were qualifying for some federal assistance for those premiums. And then as of March, over 60% of people were selecting a silver plan, which was giving them access, if they were lower income, was giving them access to even more federal assistance to help them with their cost sharing.
You're going to be really interested to see what the final data is through April 1st.
Absolutely. We're very interested to see, not just through April 1st, but ongoing. You know, the special enrollment periods, there's a lot of special enrollment periods for people if they have change of circumstance, marriage, birth, death, moving, changing jobs, change of income. There's a lot of opportunities in between the open enrollment periods where people will be changing their insurance coverage. And so, you know, we're going to be interested in seeing all along. And as well, getting back to the discussion earlier, we really want to understand who is enrolling in this coverage who was previously uninsured relative to who is enrolling in this coverage who's coming from previous coverage under Medicaid and Badger Care, or even who's coming to this coverage who had previous other private coverage. So that's something we really want to understand, and right now we just don't have a good handle on that. We don't have good access to data that's going to help us understand that.
Well, as that data becomes available, Donna Friedsam, I hope we can call on you and try to break these numbers down a little bit more.
Well, good. Thank you.
Donna Friedsam is Director of Health Policy Programs at the UW Population Health Institute in Madison. She joined us to talk about today's deadline for signing up for health insurance coverage under the Federal Affordable Care Act. We're going to take a quick break now, but keep listening. A 150-year quixotic history of Milwaukee County politics in about 15 minutes' time. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee County voters will go to the polls tomorrow to decide whether to effectively make the members of the county's Board of Supervisors part-time workers. The referendum would cut the supervisors' pay to $24,000 a year with no benefits, effective in 2016. It comes amid a climate in which members of the state legislature have sought to scale back the board's powers and in which the county board and county executive Chris Abley have fought over a number of initiatives. But if you thought this level of rancor is a new phenomenon in county government, you would be mistaken. Writer Larry Sadler looks at how the current political climate here has been informed by more than a century of history in his article in the April issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he's here to share more. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be here.
How did Milwaukee County's first 125 years set the stage for how the county would be managed in this last half century?
Well, really, in many ways, the die was cast at the very beginning when Wisconsin and then was part of the Michigan Territory, wasn't a state, wasn't even a separate territory, and the territorial government in Detroit created the county to handle courts and taxation for the territorial government. And interestingly enough, I mean, this is still a big part of what counties do is courts and taxation. And the view of counties as arms of the state has persisted all of these many years. And even though Milwaukee County has come a long way and has done a lot of things, it still legally is an arm of state government. It's not as independent as municipalities are. And that had a lot to do with how the county can set its budget priorities and how much freedom it has to decide its own fate.
Well, and one of the threads that really underlies this whole article is this question of whether there need to be both city and county governments. When did that question first start to arise?
It really first started to arise back in the middle of the 19th century. The county, as I mentioned, had been chartered first. The city was chartered, I believe, in the 1840s. And right then, people started to ask, well, why do we need both a separate city and a separate county? Because at that time, the city was the great majority of the county population. What we know now as the suburbs was very rural and sparsely populated.
You write that in the 1930s, there was an effort that came really close to combining Milwaukee County and Milwaukee City's governing, but the state shut it down.
That's precisely correct. And I should say, you know, for a lot of the more distant historical stuff in this article, I'm indebted to John Gerda and his book, The Making of Milwaukee. And I quoted John and I also spoke with him. But yeah, in the 1930s, keep in mind, the Great Depression was happening, and so money was tight, and people were looking for efficiencies, and so the idea came of, maybe we really don't need a separate city and county and suburban governments. And the idea came for one municipal government for all of Milwaukee County. Mayor Daniel Hone got behind it. They pushed through a referendum that passed overwhelmingly. Again, the city was still the majority of the county's population, still 80% of the population. But there was only an advisory referendum because the power ultimately rested with the state. The state at that time, John Goethe told me, had a legislature that was controlled by rural interests, and they wanted to look out for the rural interests in suburban Milwaukee County, and so they didn't go along with it.
And the upshot of this was that the county ended up with more responsibilities coming out of that decision, you say, almost as a consolation prize.
Right. Back then in 1936, the compromise, essentially the bone that the state gave to the metro area was that the city and county would be able to merge specific services, you know, again, with state permission. And the first one was the park system. At that time, there were separate city and county park systems. And the county took over what had been the city parks, including some particular gems like the Mitchell Park Domes, the zoo, which at that time was in Washington Park, and Lincoln Memorial Drive, the lakefront.
Let's flash forward about 25 years at this point. What was the argument that led to the establishment of a county executive position?
Well, at that time, county government was increasingly becoming more complex. It was taking on more responsibilities. By then, it was running an airport and a performing arts center and the park system, as we mentioned. County Stadium had been built to lure the Braves here. And yet it was still being run by this part-time board of supervisors and these some semi-independent commissions like the Parks Commission and the Expressway Commission and these department heads who were civil service and basically untouchable. And the feeling was that you needed a strong leader, you know, the county equivalent of a mayor, to really make this government more efficient as a sort of pseudo-metro government.
Well, and so then how far back does the friction between the county executive and the county board go?
Right to the beginning. Even before the beginning, John Doyne, who was then the county board chairman, was the primary advocate for creating a county executive, and his vice chairman, Eugene Grobschmidt, was the primary opponent of it. And as we all know, John Doyne won that fight and became elected as the first county executive. Eugene Grobschmidt then succeeded him as county board chairman. And there was tension right there from the very beginning because Grobschmidt felt that there should not be a county executive in the language of that time. He said that central government was communism. And so that was sort of the tenor that they started out off on.
And one of the interesting ideas you raise is that since the office was established at that point, it has really been an interesting cast of characters that has inhabited that office.
Very interesting. And so you started out with John Doyne, who was very polished. Everybody liked him. He was very amiable, Irish guy, attorney, former legislator, you know, very well-educated, very well-qualified. And then he was in office for 16 years, and he was succeeded by another West Side Irish politician, Bill O'Donnell, who was a very different person, not in any way necessarily a worse county executive, but from a totally different background, from a blue-collar background, former factory worker, rode the bus to the courthouse, much humbler route. He had a high school education as opposed to a law degree. And O'Donnell was in office for 12 years. And then, as many people will remember, he came to this fateful moment just as he was getting ready to run for his fourth term, where he had a falling out with his parks director, Dave Schultz, extremely colorful guy, very, very heavy at different times. He weighed, you know, 470 pounds, sometimes actually may have gotten over 500 pounds, a very quotable fellow. And Schultz got so upset about being fired that he ran against O'Donnell and won overwhelmingly, 2-1.
Now, and of course, you draw the potential parallel between that situation and current county executive Chris Abele's firing of then Parks Director Sue Black.
Yes. And there are still some people who speculate about whether Sue will run against Chris Abele. But it's a different situation because in that case, and I don't know if it's intentional or what, because, you know, Chris Abele has always been very close-mouthed about why he fired Sue Black and a number of other people in his administration. But in that case, it was after the election rather than before the election. And so You know, there was 4 years for it to fade from the public consciousness, and, you know, who knows what will happen in the future.
So let's go back to our historical timeline here. We've gone from O'Donnell to Dave Schultz, and then on to a particularly catalyzing figure, if you will, in county politics.
Yes. And then, you know, Schultz was really, by his own admission, he was not cut out to be a politician. He was a public administrator by his own admission, or his own claim, one of the finest public administrators in this country. But be that as it may, he was not cut out for electoral politics, and he admitted it, that he just couldn't handle the give and take of politics and the compromise and the public criticism. And so he stepped down. He did not run for reelection after his first term, and he was succeeded by the then county board chairman, Tom Ament. And Ament at that time, he had been on the county board for 24 years. He had been chairman for 16 years, and he certainly, you know, had his ideas about how he wanted to run county government. He had been in conflict at first with O'Donnell, later resolved his differences with O'Donnell, but was in conflict with Schultz. And then he became county executive and, you know, wound up again in conflict with the county board, which was then led by Robert Jackson, who had been his vice chairman and wound up, you know, 4 years running against him for county exec. Ament was interested in, you know, the nuts and bolts of county government. Under Ament, the county government started to contract. I mean, they had faced these financial problems from balancing these competing interests where they had to do certain things like courts that were mandated by the state and social services, which were mandated by the state. And yet there were also things that they didn't have to do but they wanted to do, like public transit and parks. And they couldn't really do it all. And so under Ament, some of these things started to get spun off. This was the time the state took over some of the social services when the county hospital, that by then named after John Doyne, was sold to Fredert. And county government started to shrink. And then, of course, near the middle of his third term, the pension scandal happened. And that really changed county government on a long-term basis.
The rest is history, as they say.
Yeah.
So the pension backdrop issue happens, and that's obviously a subject that's gotten a lot of attention. But let me ask you this. So what is your sense, if you had to put in a nutshell, how that era shapes the issues surrounding the county and its management today? You know, what is the legacy of that when we look at the current county executive and the current county board and their relationship with the state, perhaps?
Well, in many ways, the pension scandal was a turning point that shaped county government, you know, to the present day, because the reaction to that was fairly extreme. Maybe extreme is not the right word, but there was a huge reaction. There was a gigantic reaction to the pension scandal. The result was to bring Scott Walker into county government as county executive. He had never been a part of county government before. He was the first true outsider to be county executive. And he also was the first Republican. He came in with a much more conservative perspective. He was interested in holding down taxes. He was interested in cutting spending. And he came in conflict immediately with the much more liberal county board. But he also started this idea of reforming county government, of looking at, well, you know, should we reduce the powers of the county board? Although at first when he was running, he actually was talking about reducing the powers of the county executive or eliminating the county executive. You know, that idea, you know, he dropped after he became county executive. And that, you know, then really set the stage for, you know, after Walker was elected governor, that set the stage for Chris Abele, because even though Chris Abele is a Democrat and even though he has a more progressive slash liberal perspective than Walker did, he also came in with this idea of holding down taxes and of reforming county government, and much more so even than Walker, because Abele had served on a number of the task forces that studied county government and was closely associated with Shel Lubar, who, you know, gave that quote that I mentioned earlier in the show. And so Abele was immediately in conflict with the county government about that idea that county government needs to be overhauled.
You did, in reporting this article, what's believed to be the last interview with former county executive Tom Ament before his recent death. What was his view of where county government is today compared to when he was in office?
Well, he had a pretty negative view of the changes that were made by Walker and more recently by Abele. And he didn't like that idea at all of reducing the power of the county board to make the county executive stronger, which the state instituted through Act 14. And a part of that will be on the ballot April 1st for people to vote on whether to cut the pay of the county board in half. But even whatever happens with that referendum, the county board's powers have already been significantly reduced, and its budget has been reduced and will be reduced further in 2016.
But I gather he was is pretty feisty right to the end.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he said that he used to say that Scott Walker was the worst executive he'd run across, and he didn't say that anymore. That now he said that Abele was, because he thought that that Abele was trying to grab all of the power for himself. And of course, you know, Abele will not say that himself. Abele says that he's doing this for the good of county government and the good of the people ultimately. But yeah, Ament had a very caustic view of what Chris Abele is doing, and didn't care much for Scott Walker either. He said that the only service that he thought was good was no service, and that he thought that the things that Walker did through Act 10 as governor in reducing collective bargaining for public employees was also a mistake, because in Ament's view, the public employees are the main asset that government has.
You have covered county government for a long time. Never a dull moment.
No, never. And it was my primary beat for the Milwaukee Sentinel in the late 80s. So I saw the tail end of the O'Donnell administration and the beginning of the Schultz administration. It was pretty lively then, and it's gotten, you know, much livelier since as I've, you know, sort of followed it off and on over the years.
Well, Larry Sandler, thank you so much for this great historical perspective.
Thank you so much, Mitch. It's great to be back.
Writer Larry Sandler's article on Milwaukee County government and politics is in the April issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Coming up a little later in the show, what the 100th anniversary of the passenger pigeon's extinction means for our interaction with nature in this era. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's time for our weekly series, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie with the Islands of Milwaukee. We're continuing to explore the sounds of Milwaukee, and this week we have some helpers. We've been working closely with the Goodwill programs that deliver meals to seniors in their homes. The meal delivery drivers we've encountered are a fun, lively bunch.
I'm Diane Kongshug, and I drive the getaway car.
My name is Dwayne Kongshug. I'm a driver out of Beulah, Britain. I've been with drivers for about a year and a half, maybe.
Hi, my name is Pat Sprung. I've been working with the Meals on Wheels for 20 years now, and I love it because you have so many grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles. I have a client named Max or Maxine, and the question of the day was, what is the most beautiful sound in the world? And she said to me, I know exactly what you're going to say. And I said, what was that, Max? And she said, you're going to say the sound of a crying baby after it's been born. And I said, no, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I enjoy the sound of taps played on bugle.
Here are a few more answers that the drivers found.
The most beautiful sound in the world, the ripple of $100 bills.
Record player playing Chet Atkins.
The other one was my cat purring on my lap.
These drivers are navigating between homes that might otherwise be isolated. They are great, quiet connectors of the city. We have more questions of the day to be answered, and we would love to hear from you. We would love for you to take these questions to family, neighbors, or friends. Visit our website, call our Islands line, help us uncover some of the secret stories of the seniors of Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. Although they've been long gone from the Midwest landscape and skies, and in fact any landscape and skies at all, the passenger pigeon will be very much alive as the subject of an event tonight at the Riverside Park Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee. The extinction of the pigeon occurred just short of a century ago, September 1, 1914, when Martha, the last of the species, died in captivity in the Cincinnati Zoo. Natural historian and researcher Joel Greenberg looked closely at the life and death of the species in his recent book, A Feathered River Across the Sky. And ahead of tonight's talk, Greenberg told WUWM's Susan Bentz he hopes his research heightens awareness of the importance of conservation efforts today. He says his awareness of the passenger pigeon began way back when he was a grade school student.
I was in school in Skokie, Illinois, and I checked out of the library a book called Birds of America by T. Gilbert Pearson. You're allowed to check books out for 2 weeks at a time. So about the third time in a row that I checked it out, the librarian suggested I perhaps look at other books. But I've been interested in animals all my life. And at the age of 12, I became an avid birder. So of course, the bird learned more about birds. And over the years since, the decades since, I've had a particularly strong interest in what I call historical natural history. How has a region or the country changed in its flora and fauna over the years, mostly due to human changes? And so when you look at the eastern half of the United States and Canada, the story of the passenger pigeon looms just as an incredible story, both of abundance, and indeed, it's the ultimate manifestation of how rich this area was. And then on the other side, you see how quickly the vast population of passenger pigeons were depleted, also reflecting the depletion of other biological resources. It's a sad story, but it also led to changes, and there are lessons in that story which I believe are critically relevant for today.
You talked a bit about your career, where you went beyond fourth grade, but then you came back to the pigeon. It was the anniversary, wasn't it, of its extinction?
I've talked to editors about doing a passenger pigeon book, but the impending anniversary, 2014 now, of the bird's extinction gave it greater currency. And so I think that this is a unique opportunity to tell people about this really remarkable story.
So in 2011, Project Passenger Pigeon came together. This is 150 or more institutions that are involved. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I started work on the book in August of 2009. And in the process of my research, I learned that other people were thinking about the anniversary. There were a series of conference calls. I met people at the Cincinnati Zoo, met people at the Chicago Academy of Sciences, Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. There were a series of conference calls which led to a meeting hosted by Notobart in February of 2011. This brought people in from places like Cornell, the Smithsonian, Philadelphia Academy of Sciences, and out of that meeting came Project Passenger Pigeon. Specifically, what we hope to do is four things: tell people the story of the bird, use that story as a portal into consideration of current issues, specifically about extinction, our relationship with nature, and the need to build more sustainable relations with the species that we do use. And I think we've been really successful. We have, as you mentioned, I mean, probably over 160 organizations, even a few in faraway places. Their involvement varies, but between programming, exhibits, we also made a point to try to engage artists, and that's shown great success. There's a mural in downtown Cincinnati, for example, showing the pigeons, because I think it's important, you know, that we use as many techniques, use as many media as possible in bringing in new folks who might not otherwise have heard the story of the bird.
So back to the story of the bird. For those who don't know it, can you give us an overview of its state of abundance to extinction?
Sure. I mean, to me, the bird was unlike any other that human beings have ever known, and this for three principal reasons. First, it was incredibly abundant, probably had a population in the billions, but was certainly the most common bird in North America and perhaps the world. Secondly, that population often formed huge aggregations that are almost unbelievable today. So John Audubon did a three-day trip in Kentucky along the Ohio River, and for the entire 3 days, the sun was blocked by flights of passenger pigeons. The third point, and to segue into it, one of the largest flights ever recorded occurred near Fort Mississauga, Ontario, which is about 60 or 70 miles from Toronto. This was in May, probably around 1860, when likely anywhere from 2 to 3.7 billion birds crossed the skies over the course of 3 days. So that's 1860. 40 years later, due to human action, the bird was gone from the wild. The last wild birds were killed in the very first few years of the 20th century. And 14 years later, on September 1st, 1914, the very last of the species died, rendering it extinct. And it became extinct mostly because of unrelenting killing. The birds were chased throughout the year. They were prevented from nesting. You know, where they roosted, they were killed. A whole range of devices were used to kill them. And so that's really, you know, the three points that I think make this bird unique.
So why were they so sought after?
Mostly for food. They would sell for pennies a piece. They were the cheapest terrestrial protein. And so with the introduction of the telegraph and railroad in the 1840s, there developed national markets. And that at the same time as the urban centers of the Midwest and East began to burgeon, there was a demand for cheap food. The birds were used for other reasons as well. One worth noting, they were used in trap meat. So now when you go out, pigeons are made out of clay, but back then they were made out of feathers and blood. And so as many as 40,000 birds could be shot at a single three-day tournament. Now that's, you know, a relatively small part in comparison, but when you think about what it took to ship live birds from places like Arkansas or, you know, northern Wisconsin to New York or Chicago, a lot of birds died in the passage as well.
So, Joel, who was paying attention when it came down to the last few birds and a pigeon being kept in the Cincinnati Zoo? What, you know, when did alarms start going off in some people's heads?
Well, you know, there never was really an organized effort to protect the birds. That was for several reasons. One is there was an industry that was promoting the idea that the bird was still abundant. The bird laid lots of eggs and nested multiple times of the year. In reality, they nested once a year, and they only laid one egg a year. So there were still, you know, even towards the early 1882 or so, there were still one or two places where, you know, maybe there were a few hundred thousand birds, which for most birds would seem a lot, but you know, just a fraction of what there were. So in 1900, the birds were virtually gone from the wild, but there were three captive flocks, one in Milwaukee. A man named Whitaker who also had a swimming school and apparently very prominent on the Milwaukee River. And then some of his birds wound up in Chicago under the care of Professor Charles Otis Whitman of University of Chicago and the Cincinnati flock. And so at that point, these birds were being bred in captivity, but it's important to know that this wasn't part of a conservation effort. You know, nowadays zoos breed animals. Sometimes they're released in the wild. Sometimes, you know, they are the only living members of a species. But back then, conservation wasn't part of it. When they got down to one or two birds in Cincinnati, you know, there was some effort to try to locate maybe other birds to augment the few old birds they had. But those efforts were way too late to provide, you know, any real possibility of success. Oh, let me just ask this real quick. There are virtually no photos of the birds, either alive or dead. And I have not found any photos of Whitaker's birds. And I don't know. I mean, I've reached out to the Milwaukee Historical Society and various institutions, the museum, and I would love, it would be great if there were photos. People visited his passenger pigeons and they wrote about it, but I've never seen any photos of his passenger pigeons.
So, Joel, you titled your final chapter, Extinction and Beyond, and you talked about the mission of Project Passenger Pigeon and your book of having some impact on the issues of today and what might come tomorrow. Talk about that.
Sure. One way I phrase it is that the passenger pigeon story is the best cautionary tale there is to the proposition that no matter how abundant something is, could be water, could be fuel, could be something alive, if we're not good stewards, we can lose it. To me, that message is pretty much, you know, throughout the planet. And so what we're hoping to do is make people vigilant. I mean, if something as abundant as a passenger pigeon can be wiped out in 40 or 50 years, something less common can go in an eye blink. We have a law, the Federal Endangered Species Protection Act, that 1969 to 1973. That law was a commitment by this country that we would not allow, or at least we would not allow it without a struggle, for species to become extinct. And now the Endangered Species Act is under grave attack. So one of our goals would be to get people concerned enough to let their lawmakers know that they believe that the richness of nature is important and that we should do what we can to maintain the web of life and biodiversity.
We're in the beginnings of migration season, and I was thinking of leaving the listeners with what the landscape, what the skies, what they look like now versus what people would have experienced more than 100 years ago.
Well, that this idea...
Well over 100, I should say.
Yeah, really, because the last big aggregations were probably 1882 or so. It is something that people have been talking about, and it's striking to me. I mean, each generation has its baseline. So imagine somebody who was cognizant of nature in the 1860s, then talking, you know, to a young relative who grew up in the 20 years later, and 20 years after that. I was talking to a herpetologist, Steve Swanson, here in Chicago, and he related to me how he used to go out nearby, turn over logs, and find maybe 10 or 15 garter snakes. And he was out just a few days before I had met him and with some kids, young people, and they found 5. And you can just imagine, you know, those kids talking to, their children, maybe they'll find 1 or 2. Now, you know, there are success stories. Sandhill cranes, which you're talking about migration. Last week, they flew over Chicago by the thousands. 30 years ago, they were almost gone from the Midwest. So, you know, that's a bird that has just done spectacularly well. And so there are success stories. Those are the ones, you know, every time I hear sandhills as I'm trying to work in my, you know, office here in the Chicago suburbs, it's hard to concentrate when that trumpeting, you know, permeates the windows. But, you know, it's inspiration to keep going because, you know, hopefully that story can be repeated.
Joel Greenberg, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for interviewing me.
Joel Greenberg is the author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. He spoke with Susan Bentz. He'll talk about the passenger pigeon tonight at the Riverside Park Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee. We are not going extinct, but it'll be another 23 hours before you can join us for the next Lake Effect. We'll look at Wisconsin employment trends in the last decade and what they mean, and then ask the pressing question, is Superman really Jewish? I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.